What New Zealand is teaching us today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Will the attacks in New Zealand prompt the U.S. to get serious about white nationalism?
I'd like to see some kind of equivalent to what the State Department has for designating foreign terrorist organizations.
Also, Patricia Okumu was arrested after she climbed the Statue of Liberty.
There was no time for me to be discouraged or be swayed in a different direction. This was a mission.
A mission to protest immigration policy. Plus, 5 years ago today, a Crimean land grab.
Russia has proven that it is willing to use force to take territory from its neighbors.
And surf music with roots in the Middle East. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for making it here. New Zealand is a country looking for answers this week, answers to questions raised by the deadly attacks last Friday on two mosques in Christchurch. Here's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern today.
I think what the public rightly are asking right now is why is it and how is it that you should and are currently able to buy military-style semi-automatic weapons in New Zealand? And that's the right question to ask.
Ardern's government is already promising to announce changes to New Zealand's gun laws in response to the attacks. Another related question raised by the attacks, should countries be developing a strategy to fight the global rise of white nationalism? Some countries are doing that, but many are not. The Sufan Center here in the U.S. analyzes emerging threats in global security, and they argue that the federal government, governments generally, need to address right-wing extremism, specifically white nationalism, with the same focus as they address other areas of global terrorism. So what would that look like? Colin Clark is a senior research fellow at the Sufan Center.
There's multiple pillars in laying out that kind of a strategy. The first is I'd like to see some congressional hearings on the topic. Just speaking personally, I've been called to testify on the threat posed by Salafi jihadists maybe three times in the last year and a half. You don't see that same sense of urgency with right-wing extremism at all. I think there's also a funding issue in terms of countering violent extremism programs and other programs aimed at preventing terrorism. Those seem to be earmarked specifically for terrorism that's related to jihadist groups and not for right-wing groups. And then lastly, I think these are really at kind of the higher strategic level, I'd like to see some kind of equivalent to what the State Department has for designating foreign terrorist organizations. So whether that's the FBI taking the lead or the Department of Homeland Security, some domestic agency that's able to do the same thing for domestic terrorist groups.
Is it possible to rearrange funding at the federal level? Like the global war on terror still kind of can trigger authorization for use of military force around the globe. So why can't those funds also address white nationalism?
Yeah, so there's always a lag effect in dealing with this. When you look at the amount of analysts that are dedicated to focusing on Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State compared to right-wing nationalism, I think it's probably extremely disproportionate. It's not a threat that's emerging. The threat is here. It's right in front of our faces, and we need to wake up to it sooner rather than later.
Are there countries that you see that are doing work on this that you think there are models there that the U.S. can actually learn from?
Yeah, I think both Germany and the UK have recognized how significant this threat is and are starting to shift resources in that direction. I know that in Germany, there are plans to increase their ranks by 50% for researchers that are studying the right-wing threat domestically. Similarly, in the UK, there's been an 88% increase in counterterrorism operations as part of investigations into far-right extremist activities. These are countries that we have longstanding relationships with, and I think there's a lot that we could learn in terms of best practices from what these countries are doing. And again, putting the pieces together, because this isn't an issue that just affects the United States or Australia or the UK. This is a global movement, just like Salafi jihadism, and we've really been slow to recognize that.
Why do you think the U.S. has been slow to recognize that?
I think there's a lot of probably social, political, and cultural reasons why we've been slower to recognize the threat of right-wing extremism. But that's not an excuse, particularly given events of the last year. I'm talking to you today from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I live in Squirrel Hill. I've lived there for 10 years. And so
that's where the shooting at the synagogue happened.
Yeah, so, the Tree of Life shooting. So this is, this is something that's impacted my life personally. And I, I know for a fact, because I talk to the researchers regularly, that they believe that this is an issue as well. I think, again, I mentioned the lag effect. We need to start moving on this immediately to get the proper laws, authorities, and policies and funding streams in place to tackle this threat head on.
I mean, 9/11 was profound and a shock to the U.S. system. Is it possible, do you think, to track any form of extremism without overlaying it with race and political identity?
It's tough. I mean, especially in this country where we really struggle with those issues. That's apparent, right? And so there's these kind of political landmines that people are wary of stepping on. And so I think we have to have an honest, frank discussion. And that, that should really not only occur at the grassroots level, but that there's got to be some leadership driving that from the top.
Colin Clark, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Colin Clark with the Souffon Center. This weekend, yellow vest protests in Paris turned violent. You can still see the damage done to shops and restaurants in the city center. And the country's prime minister has responded that starting next weekend, yellow vest protests would be banned in certain areas. The anti-government protest began 4 months ago over the rising cost of living. Cindy Palma is a journalist based in Paris. She was at this weekend's yellow vest protest there, the 18th weekend of these protests. What is the latest, Cindy? Like, what did you see when you were covering these demonstrations yesterday?
Well, I have to say that during week 17, which was the week before, protesters were promising to come out in full force. They said that week 18 was going to be absolutely huge, and it was. We have not seen this kind of violence in weeks. And the reason why it was so big is because this marked the nearly 4 month anniversary since the yellow vest protest began. And it also coincided with the end of the grand debates that French President Emmanuel Macron was having, these series of public meetings where people could air their grievances. So it was a very, very violent Saturday, and the type of violence that we haven't seen really in a while.
So while Macron was wrapping up this kind of listening tour of people's grievances across France, there's this violence in Paris. How do you explain this violence? It sounds somewhat unprecedented, even for these yellow vest movements.
Well, a lot of people simply say that Macron's solution has not been enough. The protesters, they say that the reason why they're out there week after week is because they say that life is a struggle, that they are being taxed too much, and they feel that Macron is the president of the elite. They say that he's not representative of them. But even before week 18, though, the protests seemed to have died down a bit. But this past Saturday's protest, you really saw so many more people out there.
So you mentioned a number of coincidental things that may have pushed these numbers especially high this weekend at these protests. As for the trend of the numbers dwindling over the past, let's say, 17 weeks, doesn't that suggest that the protest was kind of dying down?
It did, especially after Macron gave his New Year's speech in which he denounced the violence at the protests. And now we have to remember that the majority of people of yellow vest protesters are not violent, but there is a handful or a group of people, if they call them casseurs in French, who are not necessarily yellow vest protesters, but are there amongst the crowd that do cause the violence and the burning of buildings that we've seen and the throwing of rocks.
So casseur means breaker, like people who break things. Is the yellow vest movement, are they distancing themselves from these casseurs?
There does appear to be a separation between casseurs and yellow vest protesters. But when you're talking about hundreds of people and thousands of people out on the streets, sometimes it's a little hard to differentiate between the two of them.
It's interesting, though. There have been some comparisons to the Occupy movement here in the U.S. in 2011, Occupy Wall Street. Protesters addressing important issues about class and economic inequality. But at the same time, as with the yellow vest movement, there's no clear leadership. And that large umbrella issue of economic inequality ends up by kind of drawing in a whole host of grievances. And the whole thing gets kind of unfocused. Is that a fair comparison?
I think there are definitely similarities because this is a movement that started on social media. And you're right, there is no clear leader. This is something that has spread through social media and has really taken off. And as for the grievances, you're right, there isn't one grievance. It's people who have a whole host of issues, although the one commonality is that it is harder for them to get by. I think for them, they're hoping that this will lead to some sort of change. But if you talk to them, too, they don't really have faith in the Macron government either.
Paris-based reporter Cindy Palm, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro meets someone he's often compared to, Donald Trump. Both conservative populists, both prone to making outlandish and hateful comments, both with associates in legal trouble. Brazil and the U.S. are also the two biggest economies in the Americas, so tomorrow at the White House, the two presidents will presumably have plenty to discuss, as we hear now from Rio-based reporter Catherine Osborne.
The backdrop to this meeting is a significant increase in alignment of Brazil-United States relations. Trump didn't pay much attention to Brazil until Bolsonaro, who modeled his campaign after Trump's, was elected. And now the Trump and the Bolsonaro administrations have been in talks, coordinating on issues like commercial relations and on Venezuela. And so about business ties, even though the U.S., for example, is the number two destination for Brazilian exports, there were trade barriers. And now the hope is that right-wing alignment can make this smoother. And then on Venezuela, which is another big issue, in both administrations, there's support for the departure of President Nicolas Maduro, and there are also conflicting factions about whether outside countries should remove Maduro through military force. So some in Bolsonaro's government said in the past they'd support military intervention, and that's something the U.S. envoy to Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, said last week he'd support.
So Trump and Bolsonaro see eye to eye on a lot, it seems. You've been spending some time talking to Brazilians on the streets of Rio. What did you hear from them about this realignment between the U.S. and Brazil on, you know, the things you mentioned, trade, politics, and Venezuela?
Yeah, so I talked to Brazilians who were going about their work day in central Rio. And as far as trade goes, they understand that the U.S. is a big economy and Brazil is still coming out of a deep recession. So many of them were cautiously optimistic about that. On Venezuela, there were conflicting opinions. I talked to one Bolsonaro voter, a credit card machine salesman named Alexandre, when he was getting a snack at a hamburger stand.
Eu acho que o Brasil está fazendo certo mesmo. Tem que tirar o Maduro. Isso é uma ditadura.
So he's saying that a transition away from Maduro in Venezuela is the right decision, but also he's happy with this more moderate stance of non-military intervention. Another person who I talked to who did not vote for Bolsonaro, a man named Lucci, who is 26, was very critical of the possibility of military action because for him it represents Brazil bowing down to what the United States wants.
So I think the relationship between Brazil and the United States is ridiculous right now. I think Bolsonaro is like a puppet for the United States, doing everything that the American government would ask him to. And the Venezuela experience is just an example of that.
So, Catherine, I want to take a step back and let's look at how and what Bolsonaro has been doing now that he's been in office for nearly 3 months. The big headline in Brazil is that people close to him have been hit with several scandals. What are those about?
Right. So corruption really has dominated the headlines in these first days of the administration. Bolsonaro's son, Flavio, has been in the news a lot for two scandals. One involves illegal money transfers from an aide of his, and the other involves him employing the wife and mother of an accused death squad leader. And then amongst Bolsonaro's cabinet, there are two ministers who've been implicated in scandals in which they've been accused of illegal campaign finance schemes as well.
All these scandals right after getting into office. I mean, the details differ, obviously, but again, another set of parallels with Donald Trump, where it seems a lot of people in his orbit started getting investigated right away. Bolsonaro has passed a decree making it easier to buy a firearm, and many in Brazil's Congress want to pass a law to widen access to carry them. Last week, there was a school shooting. What happened there? I mean, and what are people saying in regards to this law?
It was horrible. Two young gunmen killed eight people in a school in Sao Paulo. And in a conversation that followed about gun control, you started to hear arguments around it that are similar to U.S. arguments, which is that a school shooting isn't a reason to tighten gun control, but rather to loosen it. And that a teacher, for example, if they had been armed, could have prevented this. And it's interesting because there was this other massive shooting in New Zealand last week, and the response there has been so different than here in Brazil.
Reporter Catherine Osborne in Rio, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. 5 years ago today, this happened in Moscow. Russian President Vladimir Putin addressing all the big players in Russian politics and the nation from a hall inside the Kremlin. This was March 18, 2014, and Putin was announcing Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, a chunk of land about the size of Maryland, sticking out into the Black Sea. At the end of the speech, Putin sat down, signed some documents, and voila, cue the anthem. According to Russia, the Crimean Peninsula was theirs. Except the annexation was declared illegal by the international community, including the United States.
We've continued to be deeply concerned by events in Ukraine. We've seen an illegal referendum in Crimea, an illegitimate move by the Russians to annex Crimea, and dangerous risks of escalation.
Russia wasn't done, though. As you might recall, Ukraine had been going through a political revolution at the time. Ukraine's Kremlin-backed president, Viktor Yanukovych, had been ousted, and even after a new election, the country was not stable. In the middle of all that, Russian soldiers dressed in unmarked uniforms entered eastern Ukraine and, working with local separatists, started a war that continues to this day, 5 years later. More than 10,000 people dead, more than 1 million people displaced. One of the biggest crises in Europe since World War II. So where does the U.S. stand in all of this today? And why isn't the annexation of Crimea and the war in eastern Ukraine seen as a bigger deal? That's what I put to Kurt Volker. He's President Trump's special representative for Ukraine negotiations.
Well, it is a big deal. Russia claims to have annexed this 5 years ago. No one accepts that claim. The European Union and we and others have placed sanctions against Russia as a result of their invasion, occupation, and claimed annexation. Just recently, March 15th, the European Union, Canada, and the United States are coordinating the announcement of a few additional sanctions as well to mark that we still refuse to accept this claimed annexation by Russia.
What are sanctions actually accomplishing?
You know, the fact that Russia continuously seeks to have them removed is an indicator that they are having an impact. We see that Russia is unable to expand some of the businesses and relationships that it would like to do. That is putting some pressure inside the system on Putin. I think he has become more authoritarian over time, more restrictive. So I think these sorts of things are reflecting that there is pressure inside the system because of sanctions. And I think it's important that we keep them in place. And also reach out a hand to Russia and say, we are willing to talk. We want to see peace reestablished. We want to see the territory of Ukraine restored. We want to see the lives of these people, especially in eastern Ukraine where there is active fighting every day. We want to see those people's lives improved again, see the lives of people in Crimea improved again.
So you said in there one of the goals is the territory of Ukraine should be restored. I mean, do you think the sanctions are going to actually get Putin to back out of Ukraine?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. Sanctions are part of a wider strategy, not the only thing. What we have tried to do, and I talk for a moment about eastern Ukraine and the Donbas, where fighting is actively going on. And also, I should say, with the claimed annexation of Crimea, Russia has alienated the people of Ukraine. You've seen young people, especially in Ukraine, but the population as a whole, become more unified, more nationalist, more pro-Ukraine, more anti-Russian, more pro-Europe. These are breaks in that civilization that are a consequence of Russia's attacks. And I think the longer this goes on, the more it will create that schism between Ukraine and Russia. And I think that's the reason why there is still hope that at some point Russia will want to end this. And when they do, we in France and Germany and others are prepared to be as helpful as we can to negotiate peace so that the territory can be restored to Ukraine.
The Trump administration has been sending arms, as you know, to Ukraine. Is this a proxy war between the U.S. and Russia?
I would flip it around. I would say that the previous administration had a ban on sales of lethal defensive arms to Ukraine, not a ban we had in place for all countries around the world. In one place where they needed it most, where they're actually being attacked by Russia, we had said, well, we're not going to help you with lethal defensive arms. I don't think that made a lot of sense, and that has now been removed. So we now have a normal defense relationship with Ukraine, as we do with lots of countries.
We're speaking with Kurt Volker, the U.S. Special Representative for Ukraine Negotiations. Let me just take a moment. This is President Trump talking about the fighting in eastern Ukraine in an interview with ABC. This is back in 2016, before he was elected.
And frankly, that whole part of the world is a mess under Obama. With all the strength that you're talking about and all of the power of NATO and all of this, in the meantime, he's going away. He takes Crimea. He's sort of, I mean...
But you said you might recognize that.
I'm going to take a look at it. But, you know, the people of Crimea, from what I've heard, would rather be with Russia than where they were. And you have to look at that also.
So, Ambassador, that was Trump 3 years ago. Does the president today think Crimea should be a part of Russia?
Well, as you saw, the Secretary of State, Pompeo, on behalf of the Trump administration, issued a formal declaration saying the United States does not and will not recognize Russia's claimed annexation of Crimea. So that issue has been put to rest. There is no question about what the U.S. position is on this.
So here's the thing about Crimea, as you well know. Vladimir Putin sees it as a Russian possession. It's in the narrative of Russian sovereignty and Russian culture and writing a historic wrong, and lots of Russians love him for that. When he announced it in Parliament, there were lawmakers who were crying that Crimea was back. How concerned are you that that dynamic is just unsurmountable?
Well, I think in the short term, what you're describing is exactly right. President Putin is going to hang on to Crimea as tightly as he can. He, remember, has said that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. And the way he has designed his rule is that you're going to have strong leadership Putinism at home and a nationalist outlook abroad, including a right of say over its neighbors and over former Soviet territory. Ultimately, however, like the Soviet Union itself, that is not sustainable. The people of Crimea do want to be in control of their own destiny again and not subsumed fully into Russia.
But in Crimea, there are a lot of people who want to be part of Russia, and they would say their lives have improved since Russia annexed the territory.
There may be some. I'm not sure I would go so far as to say a lot. And I would certainly say that that number has gone down over time because the nature of the system that Russia has put in place in Crimea is, in fact, very restrictive, very repressive.
Would you say you've got a tough job?
You know, I wouldn't say that. I think that if you say that the definition of success is to get the territory back tomorrow, then okay, that's not going to happen. But what we need to do is build a strong and sustainable position for the United States and the transatlantic community and for Ukraine so that Ukraine becomes a successful democracy, a successful economy, a secure country that is a part of Europe. And as long as we build that strength and sustainability, then time is on the side of Ukraine getting its territory back. And I think we've done a good job at that. I think over the past few years, we've built a stronger and more sustainable position that will lead to the right results over time.
Kurt Volker, the U.S. Special Representative for Ukraine Negotiations, speaking with us on the fifth year anniversary since the Russian annexation of Crimea. Ambassador, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. Scaling the Statue of Liberty, purposely getting detained by ICE. Activists are putting themselves out there for their causes.
Actually, globally speaking, we live in the most contentious time in recorded human history as civil resistance goes.
Stories of modern activism, that's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. When it comes to symbols of American freedom and democracy, the Statue of Liberty is way up there. So 8 months ago, on the 4th of July, when a woman tried to climb the statue, it made headlines. Liberty Island got evacuated. The woman's goal? To shine a light on the detention of children arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border. Patricia Okumu has since been found guilty of trespassing and disorderly conduct. Tomorrow, she'll learn her punishment. The World's Rupa Shenoy has her story.
It was breaking news.
Just into CNN, Liberty Island is being evacuated now because of a person trying to climb the Statue of Liberty. You're looking at a live picture.
Patricia Okumu, a personal trainer and naturalized American from the Congo, seemingly just hanging out under Lady Liberty's upraised heel. Officers in helmets, secured by ropes and harnesses, crawl toward her.
Authorities forced to evacuate thousands of frustrated tourists.
We planned it and everything. I'm the 4th of July on purpose, so I'm very upset.
I had the children in mind and the children alone.
In a way, Okumu had been heading toward this moment since Donald Trump was elected president. She had never protested before.
I would work from like 5:30 a.m. in the morning until about 10:30, 11, go home, fix dinner, and come out with my banners and signs, head to the Trump Tower. In fact, I was interviewed by the host of the Young Turks. He was the first, I think you can say, to discover me.
So you're the one protester I found here. What are you protesting?
Against Trump.
Okumu says protesting became a calling for her.
I was having nightmares about the children in cages. Having been born and raised from the Republic of Congo, I used my background as a sort of encyclopedia to become a check of balance on what I'm witnessing around me.
On July 4th, Okumu joined a group called Rise and Resist, protesting on Liberty Island with a banner that said abolish ICE. Okumu went her own way.
I didn't tell a soul, and I was not intended to tell a soul because I knew there was no time for me to be discouraged or be swayed in a different direction. This was a mission.
That's how she ended up under Lady Liberty's foot and then arrested for trespassing, interfering with agency functions, and disorderly conduct. Okumu says she figured that something like a random lady climbing the Statue of Liberty would get under the president's skin.
And I succeeded. Trump, the next day, on July 5th, went to a rally and mentioned me.
You saw that clown yesterday on the Statue of Liberty? You see the guys that went up there? I wouldn't have done it. I would have said, let's get some nets and let's wait till she comes back.
So the president was addressing my action. That was a success.
Well, good. I mean, I'm glad that she sees that kind of attention as something that validates her behavior and her act.
Erica Chenoweth's at Harvard School of Public Policy. She studies civil disobedience and says we're in a new era.
Actually, globally speaking, we live in the most contentious time in recorded human history as civil resistance goes.
In the last 2.5 years, Chenoweth says the U.S. has had more acts of resistance than ever before. And now some wonder if protests have become too normal to be effective. In this media age, with its rapid news cycles, Chenoweth says it's hard to tell what will break through to make change.
It is true that one person can make a difference. And in fact, I would argue that in this instance, this person has made a difference. But that doesn't mean that she alone can win.
Okumu keeps trying. In November, Okumu attempted to climb the Eiffel Tower. She wanted to urge the United Nations to investigate U.S. immigration policy. In February, she was in Austin, Texas, scaling a 4-story building that houses a nonprofit that runs shelters for detained children.
Patricia's repeated recidivist climbing is making my job that much harder.
But Okumu's attorney, Ron Kuby, says she's taking risks that other people can't or won't.
History is made by people who are willing to take risks. They're not the people like us who sit around and dither. They're the people who act. And yes, sometimes they're a little kooky.
Okumu was convicted of the charges from her time at the Statue of Liberty. There's been a recommendation that she spend 3 months in jail. Kuby says no one's served time for protesting or trespassing at the Statue of Liberty before.
Certainly the Trump administration has decided to treat this case in a fashion different from all other cases. And that clearly is a manifestation of the Trump administration's anti-immigration stance. All they do is raise her profile and confer upon her political prisoner status.
A spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, where Okumu's charged, declined to comment. As she faces her sentencing hearing tomorrow, Okumu says she's ready to go to jail, but hopes she doesn't have to.
I was judged by the law of this country, which is embedded in white supremacy. If I had been judged on principles by the people, then I would have been found not guilty.
All that matters, Okumu says, is that she's on the right side of history. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
A new film follows another sort of bold experiment by immigrant advocates.
I'm 22 years old and still undocumented. Illegal. I don't care what you call it, really. They're all just other words for afraid.
That's from The Infiltrators. It tells the story of two young undocumented activists who were detained by immigration agents in 2012. But here's the twist. Those two immigrants got themselves thrown into detention on purpose.
We came out of the shadows and stopped a few deportations. Our own. The new plan? Get into the Broward Detention Center and get people out.
The activists' goal was to gather information from detainees to help get them released. And they concluded they could only get that info by being inside the detention center themselves. So Marcos Saavedra and Viridiana Martinez turned themselves in to immigration authorities. They were sent to Broward Transitional Center, a sprawling for-profit facility in Pompano Beach, Florida, where they started organizing the detainees. Waiting on the outside to coordinate the campaign was undocumented activist Mohammed Abdullahi. The film documents how this was all achieved with a mix of on-camera interviews and reenacted scenes. I asked Abdullahi why he and his colleagues took such a big risk when they didn't have papers.
We grew up in this country. We speak two languages. We can sort of navigate in and out of spaces that maybe our parents and maybe other folks that are more vulnerable than us in the community can't. And so it's because of that privilege that we sort of saw it as our responsibility to let's just go to the source of where people are detained. Instead of sort of sitting out here one by one by one fighting these deportation cases, let's just go right to the source.
Yourself, Mohammed, you're undocumented, born in Iran. What was your role in this effort? What did you do exactly?
We sort of internally would joke with Marco and Vidi that they had the easy job. They were inside. On the outside, we were answering calls from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. We were coordinating with family members. We had a whole team with the National Migrant Youth Alliance, people all over the country. And so my role was sort of the coordinator between both worlds, inside and out, and to ensure that Marco and Vidi got out safely.
So here's a moment from The Infiltrators. It's you and Vidi, that's Viridiana Martinez, and you're kind of explaining what you do.
You know, once it was like, okay, this case is solid, we started an online petition.
Every time somebody would sign the petition, there was an automatic email that was generated that was sent to the personal email of someone that worked at immigration. We had probably 4,000 signatures in just the period of like 12 hours.
Mohammed, what made the undocumented activists like Marco and Vidi, who voluntarily went into detention, what made them so certain that they'd be able to get out themselves? Because there's this one moment where Marco's in, you know, the detention center, and he sees this board with everybody kind of like the red and yellow and green little pin next to their name, and that suggests when they're going to be deported. And Marco has kind of this like, wow, I didn't know this was happening.
Really, the confidence for us came from the place of having done cases just like our own, where as undocumented youth, you know, we had done a whole campaign of civil disobedience. And what we found is that the more public you are about your status and the more out there you are, the safer you are. Any of us can get picked up any minute. And it's better to always be a phone call away from a group of folks that can help you than to sort of be without someone to reach out to.
And even if there is an imminent deportation, you're still giving advice on what to do. This is a moment in The Infiltrators where you're on a phone call into the detention center giving advice for a detainee who is about to be deported.
So tell him to try and refuse to board, like do the same strategy as Andy that he did, which was he told the pilot that he was afraid his life is in danger. He refused to board.
So that's a moment from The Infiltrators. We're speaking with Mohammed Abdullahi. He's one of the main characters in the film. So I don't want to spoil the end of The Infiltrators for our listeners, but I do want to follow up on one character, Claudio Rojas. One reason this project actually began is because Rojas' son asked for your help in getting his dad out of the Broward Detention Center. Your pressure campaign won Rojas' release, but now he's back in detention again. What happened?
Claudio was released August of 2012, and he was sort of doing regular check-ins. Every year he would check in with ICE. There was a period of time he had an ankle monitor. He's always complied with all of his check-ins. And so this year, February 27th, he had a check-in. It was 3 or 4 days before the sort of Miami premiere of the film Infiltrators. And when he went into this check-in, they detained him. And, you know, for us, it's a very clear sign that this is retaliation by the Trump administration, just in so much that the local ICE officers there that they normally deal with told Claudio that this decision comes from above us. And so he's at the Chrome Detention Center. It's a notorious detention center. I think it used to be a Cold War military base. Now he's, you know, a 53-year-old man. He just welcomed his first grandchild 2 weeks ago. There's no reason why he should be in that detention center other than that the administration is trying to use him as a vessel to send a message to all of us that we need to be afraid.
I alluded to this earlier. President Obama was called the deporter-in-chief. The headlines under Trump eclipse the Obama period, though. In reality, what has changed?
They are using the same system that the Obama administration built. They may be using parts of it more efficiently, other parts of it not. But what's really changed under the Trump administration is that people are finally opening their eyes. We always joke that people finally care about us as immigrants under the Trump administration because he's so vocal about what they're doing. He's so vocal about separating children. These are all things that we witnessed under the Obama administration, and we were sort of screaming into the void. We had to literally send ourselves into detention centers to be able to show people the type of people getting deported.
Mohammed, you took part in a really daring, pretty brave, kind of guerrilla-style campaign to raise awareness of all these things facing undocumented immigrants. As an Iranian, do you worry that you could be deported?
I'm gay and from Iran. I think I can manage a pretty solid campaign on my behalf should the administration try to come after me or should I end up in deportation proceedings. What I believe in is I think the same agency that I have and the same privilege I have, it's my sort of responsibility to be more out there and also for us to be able to find other ways to help other people. Everyone has a reason why they deserve to remain in this country. And I think, you know, I'm sort of a walking example of that.
Mohammed Abdullahi, one of the main characters in the film The Infiltrators. It's about a group of immigrant advocates who get apprehended intentionally by immigration agents to help others get out of detention centers. Mohammed, thanks so much for your time. Great to meet you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Okay, let's go back to the case of Claudio Rojas. He's the Argentinian immigrant who is also one of the main characters in The Infiltrators and who, as we heard a couple of minutes ago, was detained by ICE last month, just before the film's Florida premiere. ICE says it plans to deport Rojas on March 30th, despite the fact that he has no criminal record and has lived in the U.S. for almost two decades. This morning, a call came into our studios.
Esto es una llamada de y pagada por un detenido en Chrome Service Processing Center.
That's the automated recording that signals a call coming in from a detainee. It was Claudio Rojas reaching out from the Chrome Detention Center near Miami.
Hello, Marco.
Hello, how are you, Claudio?
I'm fine, and you? My English is limited.
That's okay. So, do you think you're being detained because you shared your story?
Bueno, no pienso. Yo ya lo tengo claro.
Look, I don't think it was in retaliation for the film. I know it was. The fact that I took part in it, they took that as an offense. And they detained me in retaliation. I mean, the judge didn't even give any specific reason for it.
Claudio, as we see in The Infiltrators, you're really close with your family. Are you in touch with them now, and how are they dealing with this generally?
I am in communication with my family, and they're up for this fight, especially my children. So yeah, we're in touch, and my kids are open to doing anything they can to keep the story in the press to help me win my case.
Claudio, how would you advise other families with loved ones in detention about how to cope with these really stressful moments?
Well, like you said, this is a really difficult situation. But this is not a time to crumble and let someone else decide your future. It's a time to unite with others and stand up for your rights. Don't give up and do everything you can to make sure your rights are respected.
Claudio Rojas, muchas gracias. Thank you very much for your time.
Gracias, Marco.
That was immigrant activist Claudio Rojas speaking with us from the Chrome Detention Center outside Miami. Rojas is a protagonist in a new film, The Infiltrators, about undocumented activists who get inside detention centers to organize detainees. We reached out to ICE for their response to our story. ICE spokesperson Nestor Iglesias emailed us to say ICE could not comment on Rojas' case. Hoping you had a good St. Patrick's Day. It's always good to celebrate American ties to Ireland. As long as we're celebrating those ties, here's the world's Alison Herrera with the little-known story about a group of people here in the U.S. who helped the Irish during the height of the potato famine.
There's a sculpture in Middleton, Ireland, not far from the Jameson Distillery, made up of 20-foot-tall steel eagle feathers arranged in a circle. It's meant to honor historic ties between the Irish and the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. Yep, the Choctaw and the Irish have a bond that goes back more than 170 years. It dates to the potato famine in Ireland, one of the worst famines in history. Over 2 million people died, and it prompted one of the first worldwide relief efforts.
Halito, my name is Judy Allen. I am the Historic Projects Officer at Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma.
Judy Allen grew up with the story of how the Choctaw people heard about the starvation in Ireland thousands of miles away, and they donated $170, the equivalent of about $5,000 today.
The Society of Friends, commonly known as Quakers today, had told the story of the starving Irish during the year 1847. And when the Choctaws heard it, even though it had only been 16 years since their own Trail of Tears,
when they were forcibly marched from their homeland in Mississippi to modern-day Oklahoma,
dire impoverishment and starvation, where many of our people died along that Trail of Tears, our Choctaw people felt such tremendous empathy.
Allen says that experience moved the Choctaw to pull out what little they had and donate. And it made headlines in Ireland. Here's historian Turtle Bunbury.
It gets a lot of coverage in the British and Irish press at the time because it's so extraordinary that this donation from very far away from a people who, you know, didn't have anything immediately obviously connected to Ireland or the Irish experience.
At the time, some in the United States attributed the Choctaw's generosity to their exposure to Christianity. One Oklahoma newspaper went so far as to say the Choctaws were repaying the Christian world for bringing them out of, quote, benighted ignorance and heathen barbarism. But in Ireland, Turtle Bunbury says people saw the ties to the Choctaw in a different way because of their treatment by a colonial power.
A lot of other Irish were neglected, very badly treated, pushed to the west and to the barren lands in the west of Ireland, dispossessed of their own ancestral lands. It's a very similar story, you know, in that regard.
Historians on both sides have written about the story, but it's remained largely history until fairly recently. In the past few decades, the relationship has been renewed. In the 1990s, an Irish delegation walked the 600-mile Trail of Tears from Mississippi to Oklahoma to raise money for world hunger. A few years later, the Choctaw did a hunger walk in County Mayo. And then there's that giant set of steel eagle feathers, dedicated 2 years ago in County Cork. For the world, I'm Alison Herrera.
It's weird how a sound associated with surfing in California had its roots in the Middle East and Mediterranean. We're thinking about this as tributes are coming in from around the globe, fans remembering the king of surf guitar, Dick Dale. To understand the connection between the surf sound and Middle Eastern music, it helps to remember Dick Dale's younger years. He was born Richard Anthony Mansour right here in Boston. His mom was Polish, his dad Lebanese. So Richard had this wide worldview, but it was his father's side of the family that would really impact what Richard Mansour would go on to do musically. Stephen Cuevas is a reporter in Southern California and met and interviewed Dick Dale several times. What did Dick Dale tell you, Stephen, about his upbringing and musical background?
He spoke about those days, Marco, very fondly, and he came from a pretty musical family. Mainly it was an uncle of Dick's that really introduced him to instruments like the oud and the tarabaki, a percussion instrument. And I think it was a grandmother or an aunt that introduced him to the piano. The piano was really his first love, as well as the drums. That very percussive kind of sound, you can hear it in his guitar playing throughout his career.
Well, it's interesting. So piano, which is very much a Western instrument hitting all those notes on the chromatic scale, and then the oud, which is a kind of a Middle Eastern lute, which kind of captures those little microtones that you hear in Arabic music. We actually have a really early recording of Misirlou, the song that he made famous. This one, though, is from 1927. ¶¶ I guess you can kind of hear some of those nuanced notes in there that Dick Dale would pick up on later. You told this story, Stephen, back in 2010, of how Dick Dale turned this song, Miserlou, around, making it his signature surf tune.
It's played slowly. And I said, oh, no, that's too slow. And I thought of Gene Krupa's staccato drumming, where he went, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. So you go, then you go, so I went and put Miserlou to that rhythm. And I went, like that.
Well, there you go, Marco. I mean, like, Dick could, you know, really kind of set it best. You have to keep in mind that when he recorded that song, he had started playing it in this gigantic ballroom in Balboa here in Southern California, down on the beach for all these surfers. We're talking 5,000-6,000 people. And he was going for a really big sound that the kids could really feel. And he talks about how, yeah, when he started playing that song, man, the people would just like levitate. So he might play Miserlou like 2 or 3 times at his show. And the kids just went crazy.
Yeah, I mean, Dick Dale just heard a riff, it seemed, and went with it. Thanks to Pulp Fiction, Miserlou is now the stuff of legend, even if you don't know the backstory, as you've told
it.
What is a Dick Dale deep cut that you like that is not Miserlou? Like, where else do his talent shine?
Well, I would like to throw to something from the same year as Pulp Fiction. It's from his 1994 album, Tribal Thunder, and it's the first track. It's called Nitro. And it's kind of a cousin to Miserlou, like really propulsive, really percussive. It's Dick kind of looking back on that sound, but also pushing it forward and making it this whole other new kind of beast. I see Nitro as like the Miserlou of the latter half of his career after it was largely relaunched after the success of Pulp Fiction.
Well, here's a little Nitro. That's freelance journalist Stephen Cuevas joining us from station KPCC in California. Hats off to Dick Dale today, and thank you, Stephen, for your time.
Oh, Marco, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Music from the late Dick Dale.
PRI, Public Radio International.